This podcast is sponsored by NinjaBuzz.io. NinjaBuzz.io is a marketplace which lets advertisers and podcasters find each other in a matter of minutes. If you have a podcast or if you are considering advertising on a podcast, then go to NinjaBuzz.io and check the platform out today. Once again, that is NinjaBuzz.io. Welcome to the Neutral Ground Podcast. This week, we have a special guest, Lori Singer. Lori is a licensed marriage and family therapist, board certified in applied behavioral analysis. She has devoted her life to the field of mental health, choosing to start her own company, Lori Singer Behavior Services, with a clear vision in mind to create a team for helping individuals resolve behavioral and other mental health issues by applying a combination of behavioral and cognitive behavioral therapy. Lori's brand new book, You Are Not Crazy, Living with Anxiety, Obsessions, and Fetishes, provides not only valuable information about mental health, but it also gives readers real-world guidance to help them start the process of healing. Lori's book is available now for purchase, and I highly recommend it. Please join me in welcoming our guest to the Neutral Ground, Lori Singer. Thank you for being here.
Joe, thank you for having me.
So let me jump in here by asking you about what brought you into psychology and therapy?
Well, it all started pretty much around the when my son got ill with cancer and passed away. And after that, I wanted to try and do something for the families, you know, other families, because my husband and I lived at the hospital for 2.5 months until he died. And I could see how the toll of having a child with an illness was affecting the families. And I wanted to see what could I do for the families, because we had a strong family, but others didn't have strong families. And I could see that they were suffering.
Yeah, you're right. And you do talk a bit about this too in the book, which I appreciate, which was that family support structure as well that's there, how people who are surrounding individuals who are struggling, they really can do a lot as well to kind of build that support structure that's so necessary. And let's not pretend like we all don't need a support structure really as much as we can. So how would you explain what cognitive behavioral therapy is to someone who doesn't know, or maybe just has kind of a traditional view of therapy?
Right. So when somebody calls me and they ask about therapy, I explain what my therapy is and the two modalities that I use, because they are much different than what other therapists use. It's not the typical psychoanalytic therapy where it's talk therapy, where you sit and talk about your concerns or your history, and then I just listen. This is very solution focused. So I explain to somebody before they actually come in to see me that this is going to take some work, because cognitive behavioral therapy is based on how do we change those negative or irrational thoughts that we have, and because those thoughts are creating emotions, and then the emotions are exhibited in our behavior. For example, if we think of, well, even if I would think of my son's death, for example, if I would to think about that, and it would create an emotion of sadness and hopelessness, maybe. And so that would be exhibited in my behavior, where I may not go to work. I might not take care of my daughter who is at home. I may just neglect everything in my life. So I would want to focus on how do I change those thoughts and those thoughts, and how do I change my behavior? Pretty much. So I explained to somebody, I say, okay, so when you come in, you're going to be expected to take data. We're going to analyze the data together. I'll write a treatment plan, and then they'll be expected to follow it. I make them accountable for following the plan.
Yeah. And actually, it's funny you mentioned that. I have a quotation here from the book that I'd like to read you that really kind of stood out to me, which was, you wrote, "The moment you make a choice to change your circumstances, to actively pursue a solution to the problem, you possess the seed of a cure. And one thing that stood out to me, of course, was the empowerment of this and how the way that you even structured that sentence, the idea of it's you, you made the choice to do this and how empowering that is. Could you unpack that maybe even a little bit more and tell us about why that's so critical to this therapy?
Yes. So it's so important because when people come to see me, they are so stuck and they feel like they can't get past. Sometimes it's, you know, to get them to come even to my office is huge. You know, that's they haven't been able to do anything in their life. I want them to know that they've already started moving forward. You know, I need to give them back their self-confidence and make them believe that they can do this. And the here talking with me is a step in the right direction. They've already chosen the right path. And now I just have to help them continue on that path.
Yeah. And you know, something that I think my audience will connect with, I think, because I talk about it a lot on my own podcast, is the importance of narrative today and how we narrate our lives, how we kind of understand our own stories. I found the way that you narrated these clients, you know, and of course their names are changed, but you give them such a beautiful humanity in the way you tell their stories. I'm curious, does narrative play a key role here as well? In both the side of giving therapy and even also in the side of maybe accepting the therapy as well.
Even though you know, the names are changed and the cases are changed a little bit, and maybe the gender is changed a bit, they're pretty accurate and spot on. So that's an interesting fact. But I try to. Right. They're on a negative narrative themselves, and that's why they're stuck and they keep going around and around. So one of the tools that I introduce in the book, which is also in the, you know, in the back of the book, so you could write your own, a step-by-step motivational story. So there we are changing the narrative of their thinking and their life. Just to, it's a motivational story in the fact that let's focus on what you want to change and what's positive in your life now. And there's in the book, it says individuals are to read that either 2 to 3 times a day, almost like a mantra to get them to believe it themselves.
And is there an act there of in the reading itself that you're sort of reinforcing it and making it manifest itself, let's say in reality more, the more times they read it, they make it more real. Is that why they continually read it each day?
Most definitely it is. And also in the story itself, towards the end, I believe it is one of the calming strategies that we use. So it gets them to practice it. They're given, each client, which is in the book as well, is given a weekly task schedule. So in that task list, it would be, for example, read your motivational story, practice your signal plan, your calming strategies, which is to stop, choose, and take a deep breath. They have to fill that chart out and bring it back to me so that I know they're doing it. And they do start to believe in themselves and it builds up their confidence. And then if they are coming to my office, what I do is I say, okay, now it's time to change the story because you've already moved past this and you're onto something else. And so that's the beauty of a behavioral plan. You can always change it. You know, you can always make changes.
Yeah. And you mentioned this before too, was this idea of the importance of data. And I noticed that as well as I was reading the book and I got to that section of data, I thought this is actually quite interesting and very much in keeping with today, how we use data. But what you did that I thought was particularly really smart and really good was that you took it the extra step in that you realize that data itself needs to be narrated in some way, right? We need to have some way of actually taking in the data and making it meaningful. And I was curious if when you're going through the data with clients, how much of a role does that play in their ability to actually see that change in their narrative, like you just said?
Well, for some client, like I've been doing this for over 20 years, and I think I've had 3 clients in all those years who've actually broke down and cried reading the data because they're saying, oh my gosh, this is what I do. And I can see exactly, if you know, the antecedent, if you will, what's the trigger, antecedent, whatever you want to call it. They mm-hmm. see the pattern. And they see, and then the loved ones, as a consequence, they can see how they're enabling the person. And a lot of times the either family member, they have to have their own behavioral plan because they're so used to trying to alleviate the pain of the person that comes in that they've created their own problems themselves. And so they need a distinct plan. Okay, this is what you need to do as a reaction to this individual's behavior. And this is your own motivational story, if you will. So it is, it can be, and I don't mean to make anybody cry, you know, I don't want them to feel sad. But again, I'm a very kind, I think I'm compassionate, but I'm also very factual. So I like to look at the data with the clients. And sometimes I have to tell you, Joe, I've had probably 2 or 3 cases where it's excoriation cases where they've taken the data and within 2 sessions, like they'll take the data, they come back and they say, you know what? I know what to do now. I've taken the data. I'm going to use some of these tools that you've given me. And if I need you again, I'll call you back. And I say, that's great. And here, not that I don't like my clients, but I'm solution focused. I want to give them what they need so they can function on their own.
Now, in this situation, do you think then that maybe, because it's pretty easy for us to rationalize, and I think you even mentioned this in the book, how easy it is for us to rationalize what we want to do and continue to do it. So then does the data then also provide a kind of exterior narrative that's, let's call it uncorrupt by that internal narrative that can rationalize, right? You can't say 2 is 2, 3 times is 3 times, no matter what, whatever you say. So does it provide then also a kind of, let's call it cold narrative to a degree, but a truthful one as well? Is that what they see, what they're seeing there?
Yeah. And I think also it works, a client or family might say, well, we're not making any progress. He's still throwing fits or whatever it is he's still doing. And I said, well, let's look at the data then. Let's look and see. Is the frequency, we can look at the frequency. Look, it is less than when you first came to see me. He's not engaging in that maladaptive behavior as much. And how about the intensity? How about the intensity? Is it not as intense as it was before, the magnitude? And they can look at it and they say, well, you know what, I guess you're right. They can't step back and see it. So to have that data is important because the proof is there, right?
Yeah. And if they, have you had clients who push back against the data? In other words, we see that somewhat today a lot because narrative pull is really powerful. And do you get pushback on the data where people say, I don't feel like this represents though where I am and where I'm going?
All the time.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah,
I mean, I guess it's, you know, it's 50-50, I would say. It is hard to say. You know, some people do, but then when I point it out, they're okay. And others are very skeptical. And I try to just say, you know, just give me, let's do a couple more sessions. I don't want to waste your time, you know, and I have other clients that are waiting in line. So if this doesn't work out, we could say we gave it a shot, but I'm not going to waste their time and I don't want to keep taking their money. That's what I tell them. You know, I have plenty of clients to see. So I'm okay with you. If you're saying this doesn't work and you don't want to run the plan, that's fine. You can go see somebody. I'm okay with that. But I will tell you, if you do follow it and we work together and adjustments have to be made, I believe that you can do this.
Yeah. And to your point too, it's not even so much a matter of being cold about it. It's that time is precious. It really is. If it's not going to work for you and for whatever reasons, then it's not as if we don't want people to find what will work for them, right? So time is a very precious thing. Something else too, though, that I came across in the book that I thought was really fascinating, because I've been trying to connect with this myself too, which is this idea of being empowered by our individual stories, and yet there is a tremendous amount of empowerment that we can draw from the collective human experience. And so I came across this quote in your book that I thought was really great, which was, you say, "For those reading this who believe themselves to be the first person ever to have experienced irrational, improbable behaviors and thought patterns, know that you are not." And that to me was really important, because even in my classroom, I try to tell my students, look, whatever you're feeling has been felt before by other human beings for thousands of years. And I say that not to diminish their individual story, but to highlight the fact that we have mechanisms, we have experiences in place that have been there for a long time that we can look to. I do it as a means of trying to uplift, actually. But it did get me thinking. I'm curious about, what role does a perspective of collective human experience play in kind of this healing process with you?
I think it's really important because I have so many clients, and I think it's especially the ones who are in their, you know, mid-20s, about mid to late 20s, that they're coming to therapy, but they feel like you said, they're the only ones that are experiencing this, and they have to be reassured. Some of them will say, am I your worst client? And I say, well, what do you mean my worst? Am I your worst case? Am I your worst client? Do you have anybody, you know, I don't want to use the word crazy, but they'll say crazier than I am. Do you have anybody? And I say, you know, you're not that unique. You're not that special. You're a great individual. But if I brought out a textbook, you would be, I would be reading it and you would be identifying with it. So I want you to know you're not alone. There's many other people like you that are experiencing the same thing. And you can see in their body language a sense of relief. I think it's just so that they know that there's others like them, and in experiencing the same thing, they feel, normalized in some way.
Yeah, that's a good term, right? Normalized. I think that's what we hope for. Do you find that to be something difficult in general that you deal with, though, this balancing act? And this is maybe even not so much even just on a professional level, but just in general society even. Do you find that it's a bit difficult for us today to balance that individual story with a kind of collective connectivity to humanity?
I don't know. When people come in to see me, a lot of them are so distraught by the time they come in to see me that it's hard to, I can't just open up right away and say, you know, this is a whole new world or whatever it is. They have to move slowly in baby steps there. The one case in particular in the book, the woman with the OCD, for example, that one. This individual, when they came to see me, it was the first time I thought to myself, I don't know if I can help this person. You know, I mean, really, it was a very challenging case. When I started writing the book, in fact, and they did great, unbelievable. At the time, you know, in the book, the boyfriend had to get on board as well and run their own behavioral plan because it was such an enabling, the life that they were leading. But they both did it together and they're married now, which is very cool. And when I started writing the book, I asked them to come back in to see me because it was a profound experience for me. And so I asked, and it was 6 years later. So they came back to see me and they said, you know, we still have the tools in our house. We still have the signal plan up in the bathroom. We still have, she still has her social story that she reads, needs it. And she said that she still has some bouts with the OCD, but it doesn't dictate her day anymore. Mm. She doesn't spend all day shutting the refrigerator 15 times or turning the lights back off and on or spending 3 hours in the bathroom. She'll read the social story and she moves on. And she told me, which I didn't know, she said, you know, Lori, I never told you this, but at the time that we came in to see you, I was really contemplating ending my life because things were so bad. And I thought, oh my gosh, I didn't know that at the time. I knew that this person was really suffering. But the fact that 6 years later, they're still using the same tools and reading the same story, and they've been able to progress. It was really, and I thought to myself, this is why I keep doing what I do.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, and even the way you just told that story, you can hear how important that was, how uplifting that was for you as well, and how we all can actually, hearing that story can have an uplifting effect on all of us to a degree. And that's what I like about the whole connection of narrative here in general, the way you narrated from beginning to end, you know, including the wonderful ending stories, which were fantastic to read. The results that happened were wonderful. Well, let me ask you this then, because it's an important question. We all have, to a degree, anxiety, right? And in some ways, it's built into us from evolution even, right? So where do you see professionally the line between, let's call it a normal level of anxiety, for a lack of better term, or just for clarity here, normal level, when does it become a problem that must be addressed?
Yes, we all have anxiety, that's for sure. I mean, I have anxiety still myself, but I'm able to control it because I put it in perspective. It's when we can't control it, when it starts to consume our thoughts, when it starts to affect our lives, either socially, with our job, with our education, our outside life, with our relationships to others, when it starts to affect us in that way, or becomes to where we ourselves feel like it's overwhelming, these negative thoughts, then we need to seek help. Because what's interesting is when people come to see me, they don't realize what I have to instill in them is that self-confidence that you really are in control of what you think. They don't believe that they are. They don't believe that they can control what they think. They can stop themselves and say, hey, I am not going to let you come into my mind. That's it. You're going out. They've given up and they've just let that negative thought process take over. So I don't know if I answered your question.
No, absolutely. Right. I mean, you know, even I had anxiety about, you know, anytime I'm beginning an interview, I'm anxious, you know, about it, but it didn't prevent me from logging on, saying hello to you and starting this interview. However, could I envision a point where it could for someone? Of course, absolutely. And you can imagine how even just, you know, one time leading to two, leading to three and four, and now you have a real pattern, right? You mentioned patterns in the book. You have a real pattern that you start to become comfortable with of avoiding that particular moment, and how something that I see just every, you know, semester with young freshman college students is how quickly that pattern can build and become something, you know, much more. And correct me if I'm wrong, the more you wait, I would imagine, the more difficult it becomes, because we're patternistic, you know, we're a patternistic species, really. Is that correct? Am I assuming too much?
No, that is 100% correct. It's 100% correct. There's two things here. And one is that the longer you engage in a behavior, the harder it is to change. I mean, that's just a fact. You can think of smoking cigarettes. I mean, if somebody came in to see me and they said, hey, I've been smoking for 30 years, I want to quit, I'd say, okay, great. And I'd write a plan. It's going to be more difficult for them to quit than if somebody else came in an hour later and say, hey, I want to quit smoking, and I just started 6 months ago. Well, typically the person that started 6 months ago is going to have a much easier time than the person that started 30 years ago. And I did talk about in my book too, how when I was experiencing anxiety, which then turned into panic attacks, or I wouldn't drive on the freeway. And how realistic is that when you live in Southern California, especially my job at the time, to travel from house to house. So that I had to get that taken care of right away, because I wasn't going to be able to continue working if I wasn't going to go on the freeway.
Yeah, a very real life example. And you know, something else then that you mentioned in the book, this particular section as well, I'll read it here because I thought it was really powerful, which was you talk at one point about when they first enter the office with you, right? And you say, we can all agree that we want to solve this problem, right? So are we all willing to commit to participation in the work at hand? And then you say this, you say, this moment is always key. I try whenever possible to get a verbal yes from everyone. Why is it important for you to get a verbal or vocal yes in that moment?
So it's interesting that you say that, because there's typically, when a family comes in, it could be just the mother and child or a couple, there's always one that's skeptical, you know, no matter how large the group is. And so I can typically read body language and just pick out the one who is not really on board. So then I will tell them, like, if it was you, I'd say, Joe, you know, are you in agreement? I'll call people out and I'll say, okay, I need for you to look at me and let me know, are you going to buy into this? Are you going to be a part of it? Because it's really important that you do. And then you might say, well, you know, we've tried therapy before and just isn't going to work. But I, you know, my mom told me I had to come, or she wouldn't let me watch videos or something. So at least if you're on it, I say, well, I appreciate your honesty. That's great. But I need to know that you're going to at least try, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. It reminded me of something that I'll tell students as well, which is about thinking critically. I'll tell them, okay, after you've thought about this idea for a while, whether you're in a room by yourself or you're with someone else, I want you to just say it out loud. Hear it. Because you will experience that in a different way. It will become more real when you put it out there vocally. And oftentimes, I mean, I'll do this myself. I'll say something when I'm practicing, you know, I'll write a lecture out for class or something like that. And as soon as I say it out loud to the class, I hear it and I go, that was ridiculous. That made no sense. It made sense in my head and on paper, and then it just flopped. So I'll tell students, when you're doing this, you're dealing with something important, say it out loud. It made me think about how, again, empowering, I'll use that word, for those who do say yes and can say yes, how there's this moment of, okay, I just took it out of here, this private place, and I've made it public. I've got to follow through with it. Is it wrong to maybe apply a little pressure to them at that point and say, look, you made this public, you want to do it, let's follow through? Is that wrong to do that?
Well, I don't know if it's wrong, but that's what I do. You know, I think it's important. I want to hear what they have to say. I don't want them to hold back. And I need to let them know my experience and how I know that if they jump on board with me, I can help them. But if they're going to be defensive, if they're not going to believe it, this won't. That's the bottom line. And it's interesting that you say about the saying something out loud, because when I have my clients come in, I have them read their motivational story out loud. I have them, because they'll say to me, can I read it to myself? No, you have to read it out loud. I want to hear it out loud. And I tell them, we're going to go over the story, because I write the story from the data they've taken. And I say, if there's anything that you think we should change, or if you don't like in it, we can always change it. It's a Word document. It's not written in stone. Typically, there's very few times that we've had to change something, but I still give them the option. And sometimes I will even say, if they come in with a partner or a parent or whatever it is, I tell them, I need for you to read this out loud to your parent every night or to your partner. Again, it's saying it out loud makes a difference.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious too about something else. So we're still very much dealing with a pandemic and a lot of different pressures and different ideas coming from all over the place. Maybe a couple of questions here, kind of in one, two in one. Are you seeing an uptick in anxiety or in certain patterns, maybe unhealthy mental health patterns? And if so, how would you recommend people start analyzing those patterns in terms of whether or not to reach out in some capacity to a professional like yourself?
I mean, there's a huge increase with anxiety. And there's a big increase with maladaptive behaviors that can be associated with anxiety. Any OCD behavior feeds off the anxiety. So it's been, it's really hard for me because I don't like to turn anybody away, because I know that when people reach out to me, they really need. And that was another reason why I wrote the book, is because I want to be, and somebody to have the tools to work with a family member, maybe get through it first. What I would say is first to try and realize that everybody is going through a really hard time. You're not the only ones that are experiencing anxiety. You can, due to the pandemic, whether it's economic or social distancing, or do I wear a mask or don't wear a mask? Or if I don't wear a mask, will I get a dirty look? Or, vice versa, whatever it is, everybody's thinking the same thing. So I think to normalize it first, but then the signal plan that's in that book is just so easy to use. And there is, I know it's not in color, but you can download your own signal plan, or draw one, or just visualize it in your head. But you need to stop that negative thinking and try and get a hold of that anxiety. And then just stop yourself and make a choice, like, everybody's going through the same thing. That's right. It's not just me. It's everybody. And then take a deep breath and move on. It's okay. It's all right.
Yeah. Would you say that anxiety is the most difficult mental health problem, or is the most prevalent mental health problem coming out of this so far, specific anxiety, or like you said compulsion, right? Or obsession is a part of it. Is any one coming through more than the others?
I think what it is, Joe, from what I've experienced, is that it starts off as anxiety, and then maybe for people engage in maladaptive behaviors because they think it's going to alleviate some of that anxiety, whether it's a ritual from, whatever their OCD behavior is, or if it's self-harm, like skin picking. Oh my gosh, so much skin picking, the excoriation, or even body dysmorphic disorder has been huge among the new influx of females that I've gotten, because they were, especially the high schoolers, because they were home from school. They've had all this time to take selfies, and their body image, which has become a compulsion plus anxiety because it's not meeting up to what they think they should look like when they post it. And then eating disorders. I mean, the anxiety takes on a life of its own in other manifestations.
Do you see, I mean, because I'm sure someone has asked you about this before, do you see this social media experiment, let's call it, because it is still in some ways an experiment with humanity. Do you see this as something that eventually we're just going to have to deal with? On just a human level, we're going to have to start maybe looking at it from a different perspective because of the negative impact that it's having?
Well, there's a lot of clients that I have that have been negatively impacted by social media, and they've been targeted against and for something that they didn't do, but were accused of doing. So I see that part of it. I mean, there's just so much. It's like, where do you start with that? Or do you start with trying to get somebody to believe that you're beautiful? For God's sake, you're like 20 years old. You're beautiful. You need to enjoy who you are right now and not worry about you know, your ankle or your wrist or whatever it is that they're not satisfied with, to try to get them to look at themselves as a human being as a whole, and that nobody's perfect inside, outside, whatever it is. We're all just human. And I try to empower them, and I hope that they get to where they need to be by the time that they end my services. I don't know what to say about the future. I don't know what to say. It's
I hear you, because it's a difficult question. You could come at this question from so many different angles and different professional perspectives all over the place, technology even in general, and everything. And we're so wrapped up in it at this point as well, that it's not as if you could just turn it off, right? It has its benefits, of course, but trying to get that message across, like you just said, right? I mean, you could take whatever magazine you want and take the lead cover model. And if you ask him or her, you know, what do you hate about yourself? I mean, I guarantee they'll rattle off, you know, 10 things. And the rest of us will just kind of go, are you serious? Like, what are you talking about? But there is something of value in that, isn't there, to think like, okay, if they're thinking this, and again, we bring it back to that idea of that shared collective human experience, maybe there is a part of us that starts to that should start thinking about seeing each other collectively. Like, look, we all think this, we all have these emotions, let's normalize them, but in a way that helps us move forward, right? Because it's more than just acknowledging it. We have to kind of acknowledge it and say, I don't need to think these negative thoughts of myself. I don't have to. It's not, certainly not helping me, and it's not helping the world. So where's the value in it, quite honestly?
There is no value in it. And it just, that's the part that I think where people get stuck. And in the beginning of the motivational story, I always name at least three things, three positive attributes about that individual. You know, I want them to know you're smart, you're fun to be with, you're a good mother, you're a good daughter, whatever it is. And that you may have OCD, you may have anxiety, you might have a psoriation, but that define who you are as a person. That's what's important for them. It's because you're right. What happens is they lose sight of those positive attributes and what they have to offer other people, and how people, and I always say in there, and my family loves me, or so-and-so supports me, so that they realize, yes, I do have a team. I have a team of people that care about me.
Yeah. And the I did notice that too, the positivity at the very beginning, the opening kind of paragraph. I know one of the people in the book, he had mentioned, and I'm really good with cars, and I'm really good with, you know, all this other stuff. And I thought, there you go. You've got to acknowledge that good that's within you already, or it just becomes too easy. I mean, I'll ask students sometimes to write, what's the best thing about yourself? And they just stare at me like they have no idea what to write. And usually I'll stop and I'll say, okay, but if I had asked you to write down 10 things that you dislike about yourself, how many of you could do that pretty easily? And they'll be honest, you know, because students are great that way. They'll just tell you, oh yeah, I could have named 10 to 50 things that I hated about myself. And we'll just talk about why. Why is it so difficult for you to say one wonderful thing about yourself that's truly unique? And so my question to you then, oh, go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to say, and like you said, that one positive thing, and have that replace the negative things. Focus on those positive things.
Yeah, and almost a kind of heroic declaration. You know, I'm this, and here's what I do. Here's what I offer to the world. And in reality, no one else can offer that to the world in my way. And it's a wonderful sort of way of reinforcing, again, that uniqueness, but a value to the collective whole as well, the collective society. And I'm curious about if, how difficult then, is that the most difficult part of their motivational story, is when you ask them, write something good about yourself?
So here's the thing, Joe. Through the, I get the history, you know, they talk to me about the history of the problem behavior, when they don't even, typically they're like, well, I don't know when it started really. And I said, well, let's talk about it. Because typically there is a spot of when it started. Not that we have to dwell on that, but I want them to recognize that, you know, that could be a trigger in the future as well. This is when it started. And then it just kind of took on a life of their own. And then they take the data, and I'm the one that talks about the positive attributes. So when they see that written down, it's like for the first time, and it's like, oh, yeah, I guess so. Because they're not focusing on that right now. They're only focusing on the. So for them to read it out loud, to see it on a paper, I guess I am. I guess I am smart. I guess I am a good parent. It's almost like the first time they're hearing it.
Wow. And do they have, I mean, so they're a little bit taken aback by reading that. Do they, I mean, do you get people who push back against seeing that as a kind of truth, almost as if it's like they don't want to believe it in some ways? Or is it more like they're like, well, thank you for that, actually?
They actually like it. They do. Good. People like it because it's almost like, oh yeah, I forgot about that part of me. I forgot that I am a good human. You know, they forgot that part. And the interesting thing too is what there's the excoriation one where it says, which we can do with anything. It could be excoriation or smoking or eat, whatever behavior you're trying to stop. You have to have a behavior for. But what it, there's a section where it says, no bargaining with myself, because bargaining doesn't work. And they all laugh at that part because everybody's bargain. Okay, I'm just going to pick this one pimple right here, and then I'm going to stop. But the problem is that they don't stop. They don't feel good about themselves. They did that. And then they just give up. So it's that self-bargaining that we have. I'm just going to do it once, and I'm going to go back to it tomorrow. I'll be back on my plan tomorrow. It doesn't work that way.
Is there an element, because it is of course very easy for us to let ourselves down. It is. Is there an element of, I guess what I'm trying to ask, does it help or does it hurt sometimes to have that accountability to, let's say, a family member, where it's like a family member might say, you let me down, which would seem like a natural, you know, we can feel that, of course, at times. But do you find that to be, is that a tricky balance of accountability there?
And do you mean that not the individual with the maladaptive behavior, but another individual in the family is let me down?
Yeah. So I guess, what I'm saying is if it's just up to us sometimes, it's very easy for us to say, well, I'm not worth it anyway. Who would care? So I'm going to continue to do my maladaptive behavior. And there's, of course, a real problem of self-worth there. And yet we bring in other people as support to help bring that self-worth up and say, look, you have value to me, a lot of value. And I guess my question has to do with, is it actually quite a difficult balancing act for that other person, maybe the relationship, where that other person has a right to say, you've let me down, versus constantly just being supportive and just saying, you can never let me down. You can, no matter what you do is great. Like that always seems to me to be a really, really difficult balancing act.
Well, I always say, I point it out. So a lot of times what happens is the individual with the maladaptive behavior doesn't understand his or her behavior in a social context, which means how is that person's behavior affecting the entire family? You know, it does have a strain on the family, and it, you know, it may be, whether it's a parent or parents, it's affecting other people. So you have to step up and do what you're supposed to do, because not only are you hurting yourself, but you're affecting other people in a negative way. And I think, you have to tell people that, because I think they're so self-absorbed in their own behavior, and the other people in the family are afraid to say anything, either that or they're blaming the individual. It can go either way, but then that person needs to stop blaming and just say, instead of blaming them, just let that person know how their behavior makes you feel instead of blaming them. And then you need to do something for yourself and not blame that person. So it's a whole web It depends on each person that you get in here. I think there's the conversion disorder case that's in there. And, you know, the family with the conversion disorder is another form of panic, except that it comes with physiological symptoms like either a seizure or blindness or whatever it is. And that affects the entire family. And the family has to learn what to do in response to that. And it's hard because it does affect the whole family. But the individual needs to understand your parents or your family love you very much, but I'm going to give them a plan that they're going to follow. And then you're going to have a plan that you're going to follow. And the reason why you're doing it is because you love each other and you have to make healthier choices. It's all about making healthy choices.
So accountable love, let's say, right? At the very least, you do have to recognize that accountability is an act of love as well, to a degree. It is fascinating. What would you tell someone who is maybe a family member of the person who's struggling? What would be a good way to approach that person that they care about maybe something that's a maladaptive behavior that they may not even be 100% aware of?
No, they are not aware of it at all. Because they're too close to they can't step back and see what is the function of this behavior. Why are they engaging in this behavior? Because we all engage in behaviors for either one or four functions. And so once the data is taken and we can see, maybe it's attention seeking. Okay, so this is what you need to do. So I give the parent a plan or whoever, the spouse a plan. You know what their reaction is? Relief. It's relief because somebody was able to be objective, take it from the data and say, explain to them, look, this is what you wrote down. I want to show you this is happening just before. This is what's happening as a consequence, what you're doing. So whatever you're doing right now isn't working. So we need to change that.
Yeah. So start taking your own data in a sense first to have that.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Start taking you would instruct the other person to start kind of developing their own data of the situation first.
So in the book, Joe, there's two different data sheets. And one data sheet is like, let's say you were my client coming in, and then if you were married, your partner would come in and I would give you a data sheet that is from your perspective. And then your partner would have a data sheet from their perspective. So it could be the same situation that you're both viewing completely differently. And that's important because the other person never gets to really say their side. And then they can see a pattern and perhaps you can see something or you can explain something that your partner never knew. So it's enlightening for both people.
That's interesting because we have that old kind of story of therapy where people feel like, oh, the therapist is just going to be against me and it's going to be all my fault. And here you're saying, no, we're trying to figure out. You're going to have your say. I want people to have their say of the situation because all of that, to a degree, is data that we can use, really.
That's right. The conversion disorder, that family that came in, the mom was so relieved. I mean, when she took the data and was able to now deal with something differently in a different manner, it was just very empowering for the client, but for her, what she needed, because she felt like a failure as a mother and that she wasn't doing enough and, you know, whatever was going on. And so this was very empowering to her.
Yeah, I would imagine. Well, I'd like to ask you about just a couple more things. One would be your thoughts on what would you tell parents today who are struggling with, let's say, balancing their children in this precarious environment of a pandemic with so much information. What would you stress in a general context to parents today raising, let's say, young children and maybe even young teens as well?
Well, first of all, I'd be very careful what you say in front of your kids, because even if you think they're not listening, if they're in the same room, kids can pick up on anything. And so I would be very careful what type of conversation you're having. and what that involves, because, you know, just recently I had a client who was 10 years old and shared custody with the parents, but the dad was very nervous. He was a teacher and he was, you know, really strict with this child as far as socially. And he was, of course, he didn't go to school and all these other things. And the child became very, very depressed. And the reason why they reached out to me was because he drew a picture of a tombstone with his name on it. And he said, maybe I'd be better off this way. So they brought him in and we, you know, had the parents take data, the child take data. He needed to learn how to identify his emotions and then how to regulate those emotions. So I have a 5-point scale or 3-point scale, depending on how old they are. So he can identify, if I start to yell, it's because I'm feeling frustrated. So what can I do? What's an alternative behavior? And to kind of gauge how that is. But then the dad needs to learn, or the mom, how to control themselves for kind of projecting onto their kids how they feel about something, because it really does affect the kids. So that would be number one, I would say. And then practice, you know, you could practice deep breathing with your kids, you know, say, you know what, let's do an app on the phone together. Let's take 5 minutes every day and do a meditative app. I think that would be great, you know, like that. And then what I always tell parents, when you say goodnight to your kids each night, no matter how old they are, name one positive thing that you like that they did that day, because they're going to go to sleep on a satisfying, happy note saying, wow, they really liked when I did that. And be specific about the behavior. You know, I really liked it at the dinner table when you told us about your, you know, what happened at school today. I really appreciate it. They're going to go to sleep going, wow, they really like that. Okay, I'm going to talk more about my school then.
Yeah, I mean, because we, you know, it's funny. We do recall those moments. You know, as we get older, we recall those moments of kind of, you know, positivity, hearing this from our parents and, you know, and people, relatives in general. They stick with us more than we think at the time, of course. So yeah, I could see that. And plus you mentioned the breathing part too. Even that becomes a shared practice. And you mentioned kind of the importance of rituals in the book as well. And even that could be kind of a memorable ritual that brings peace, even just thinking about it at a certain point, right? We can have that a body reaction of peace, quite honestly. My last kind of question here, a specific question, would be, I deal with a lot of undergraduates, freshmen from roughly between the ages of 17, you know, all the way to the occasional like 21-year-old, essentially. What advice would you have for them dealing with, you know, being a young adult in this kind of anxious environment as well?
I know, it's so, I feel so, I mean, my heart goes up, really, it really does. It's been a difficult, and I try to, you know, of course, give them hope. At the same time, everything's been cut off. And then it's almost like we say, okay, not yet, go. Wait, just kidding, stop, go, with their social life. So I think learning how to realize what you can control, and try to focus on any little bit of positivity you can. I mean, some things we have no control over, and we just have to let it go and take a deep breath. And other things we can control. Even if you have just, you don't have to have a whole bunch of friends, but if you have one or two good friends, focus on that in the relationship that you have. That would be mine.
Yeah, because depression and anxiety tends to put us in a place to almost seek out solitude, right? And so it's almost like you have to have people around you to say, hey, I know what you're doing. You're trying to do that solitude thing. Come out with us and just, you know, hang out, that kind of a thing. Yeah.
And then also, just, you know, Joe, more recently, I had a college senior, actually, he's a senior. He started seeing me last year. And he kept putting on this fake facade around his, you know, some of his peers. And I said, you have to let them know how you feel, you know, no matter how difficult it is for you. So he did. And then he sat them down and he told them, and what a relief, and everything's worked out. But it's hard. It's hard for adults to learn how to communicate. So even people who are in college, I think if you can start working on the I feel because, or when you, it's going to be life-changing for these young individuals.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. Lori, do you have any other kind of things that you'd like to make known or to tell us about the book or about yourself or where people can kind of find you?
You can go onto my website, yournotcrazybook.com, or my other website for my company, Lori's.com. I think they're both interrelated that way. I would just like to get across, the reason why I wrote the book was because I have a lot of physicians in the area that they refer clients to me, and this stuff really works. And they say, Lori, you should a book, because what you do works. Not only about prescribing a medication, which kind of puts a band-aid on it and may relieve some of the symptoms, but it's not going to get rid of the problem. And so finally, I did write a book, and I wrote it with the intent that there are tools in the back. You can use them. They really do work. And I just put the word out there that these two combination of therapy, cognitive behavioral and behavioral, can be life-changing in a positive way.
Yeah, I think the book is wonderful, and I encourage people to read it, especially even if you are not the person necessarily who is dealing with the maladaptive behavior, but it's an excellent resource as well for people who want to help someone that they care about as well. I think that's a message that I'd like to get out there as well, is how we can help multiple audiences in that way. So let me give the title again and make sure that I thank you properly, because this was absolutely wonderful. And I think you probably have helped a lot of people even just getting this message out. So I encourage audiences to check out Lori's book, You're Not Crazy, Living with Anxiety, Obsessions, and Fetishes. Lori, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing all this wonderful information with us.
Thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure talking with you, really.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. If you did, consider buying a copy of Lori's book or passing it on to someone else who might benefit from it. Additionally, consider sending a thoughtful comment to either me or Lori at theneutralgroundpodcast.com. I'll make sure that Lori receives it. I'm pretty sure that she will appreciate any kind words that you might have, and I know that I will. And if you haven't yet done so, please subscribe or follow the podcast on whichever platform you're currently using to listen. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please take a moment and leave a kind rating and comment. 5 minutes of your time will make a big difference in my day. As always, try to keep one foot firmly planted on the neutral ground, and have a great day.